Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, it's Francis. You know, every once in a while, we get to spend some time with an icon in the world of food and get into their backstory. We don't often get to do that with two icons in one show. Well, here's one of those from last year, where we got to talk to the great Nigella Lawson and Prue Leith from the Great British Baking Show. Have a listen. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. So if you're like me, you have spent dozens of evenings over the past few years watching The Great British Baking Show. It's such a sweet, mellow hour, you know? It's a competition show where the contestants are all regular people or just doing their best. They really seem to genuinely like each other. And the stakes are never that much higher than a nice piece of cake. It's a balm for these intense times, but that's not to say that the show doesn't have character. A lot of that character comes from the judges. For the past five seasons, Prue Leith has been one of those judges, the one with the fabulous sense of style and who always likes it when the bakers booze up their desserts a little. She's caring and supportive, and before you start thinking, though, that she's just a nice lady on TV who likes rum cake, she's got a whole groundbreaking history as a chef, restaurateur, and cooking teacher. She's got a new book called Bliss on Toast, and she joins us now. Hi, Prue. It is so lovely to have you in the studio. How are you?
I'm really well, and I'm loving New York. And it's such an honor to be on this podcast. I'm really pleased to be here.
Well, thank you for saying that. And New York loves you too, so we're glad to have you. And, you know, you've flown quite a way to get here to talk about something as important as we're going to talk about. So I want to treat it with the level of respect that it deserves. And that is, I love toast.
Well, I think it deserves respect.
Everyone loves it. So how did you come to write a book about food on toast?
Well, two things. One was that in lockdown, I was making food for two for months and months and months, just for me and my husband. And I'm a caterer and a restaurateur. I cannot cook for two all the time. It's just too boring. So, of course, I'd make roast chicken or casserole or something for four people at least.
Sure.
And then, of course, we'd have to eat it leftovers because I'm much too Scottish to ever throw anything away. So, and all these things would end up on toast. And then I realized, actually, everything tastes better on toast. So that was the origin of the toast. And the other thing is that I've been doing recently a review of hospital food, trying to help the National Health Service do better food in hospitals. And the single biggest complaint we had from patients was that there was no toast, that they couldn't get toast. You know, toast is so comforting. It's what we, at least the Brits, we all go to toast. If you're not feeling well, even if you're feeling quite sick, you can eat a bit of dry toast and it's really comforting. Then you get a bit better and you want toast with butter on it. And then if you're a Brit, you want toast with butter and marmalade on it. Toast is a sort of national sacred thing. And to not be able to get a bit of toast in hospital is disgraceful.
You know, it's funny because when I was young, when I was sick, you know, my mother would say, you shouldn't eat any food, but you should eat toast. Mm. And now that I look back on it, I think, my family's Chinese. Like, bread exists, but it's not like our staff of life. I don't know why.
But she still gave you toast.
And not rice. Well, she grew up in Hong Kong, which was a British colony. Yeah. So maybe she had been inculcated with this British love of toast.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So looking at the book, which is, you know, tidy and small and lovely, and the recipes are very simple. Mm-hmm. They all look fabulous. And there you have a great note in there, which is, you know, it's a cookbook. It's about toast. I mean, frankly, you should be able to look at most of the pictures and just be able to make this thing. So it's really about the combinations. There are some really lovely recipes in there as well. But in thinking about putting it together, I know you said everything tastes better on toast, but I'm sure you have ideas about what rules about what you would follow when composing.
Exactly. I think that all trained chefs and most people who become good cooks end up knowing what goes with what.
Sure.
If something is very rich, you need something which is a little bit acidic to cut through that richness. Mm-hmm. If something's very dry, it needs something creamy or oily to go with it, and so on. So sometimes it's about texture. Sometimes it's about taste. You want a contrast of taste. Okay. And you don't want too many flavors, I think.
Okay.
The problem with a lot of bad cooks, frankly, is they've put too many flavors in. And then it's like mixing a pot of colors. You know, if a child has a paint box and they mix every single color together, which they always do, you end up with brown.
Yeah, it's just
very,
always
very boring.
Brown. Yeah.
And the same thing happens with your taste buds. If you have too many flavors, there's no flavor. So, I think what I'm trying to do with the Bliss on Toasts is to give people inspiration to do other things. Mostly when I write recipes, I'm rather boring about it. I say, if you want it to work, follow the recipe. Don't tell me you don't like it, and then it turns out you thought if I put one glass of sherry in it, three glasses would be three times better. It wouldn't.
I've watched you on TV. I think most of the time you would say that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I do like a bit of sherry. But all right, that's perhaps a bad example. But a lot of bad cooking comes from people not following the recipe.
Sure, sure.
If they, professional cookery writers spend ages, you know this, getting the recipe right, getting the measurements right. So it's better to follow them. But in this book, I'm not saying that at all. The whole idea was that people are too busy and they have no time and no money. So basically, these things on toast are generally not expensive. There are a few luxury things there. But
those
most
are the luxuries,
of them,
yeah.
But most of them are about a dollar. The ingredients cost about a dollar. And I also think that we shouldn't be snobbish about good store cupboard ingredients. I mean, not everybody wants to make their own mayonnaise or their own hollandaise or their own even flatbread. I've given recipes at the back from how to do these things yourself if you really want to. But I'm not expecting people to do that. I think it's perfectly legitimate to have tapenade out of a jar or pesto out of a jar or mayonnaise out of a jar. Why not, for goodness sake?
Yeah, for sure. Although there is a wonderful recipe in there that is for pesto that I don't think you can buy out of a jar because you call it English pesto.
Yeah.
And instead of basil, pine nuts, and parmesan, you have parsley, walnuts, and cheddar.
Yeah.
And that
really
sounds
good.
Fabulous. And you
it
just make it like
fairly good. And rapeseed oil instead of olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
And it is lighter than pesto. You know, pesto is absolutely delicious because of that heavy basil and its richness of the olive oil. But you can't eat a lot of it because it's just very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The English pesto is much milder, and I actually prefer it.
Your invention, or is that a
thing? No, I invented it actually for a book a few books back. But you get lots of pestos now made of all sorts of things.
For sure, for sure.
Yeah.
So the recipes, again, they're as much suggestions as they are recipes. They're all very simple, and I love that spirit that you talked about. But you also famously ran a restaurant with a Michelin star when you were one of the, maybe only, certainly one of the only women who had a restaurant with a Michelin star in London at the time. How did you get into food?
Well, I grew up in South Africa, and to be honest, I never thought of being a cook in South Africa. Mostly because it was under the apartheid, absolutely iniquitous apartheid regime.
Mm-hmm.
And there was job divisions. You couldn't even be a bricklayer if you were black. But on the other hand, it was very difficult for a white woman to be a cook.
Mm.
And so I grew up with really good food. We had a Zulu cook who was a great chef.
Mm-hmm.
He had been a top chef in a French restaurant. And he could have taught me to cook, but it never occurred to my family, or indeed to me, that I should go in the kitchen. So it was a very strange life. But of course, I didn't think it was strange because I was...
It was normal,
It was normal for me. And so it wasn't until I got to Paris that I realized just how important food is. You know, you'd go to a brasserie or a cafe and stand at the bar. And I remember hearing some guy who was obviously a captain of industry or something talking with his chauffeur, his driver, about where he was going to eat that night. And they were discussing food. And the metro worker next to the driver who joined in, and they were all talking knowledgeably about where the best, who made the best steak frites and, mm-hmm, and where mm-hmm. they... I remember somebody talking about a restaurant where they grew their own raspberries and things. And I thought, nobody talks about food. When I was growing up, food, there were about five things you never talked about. You never talked about God. You never talked about religion. Never talked about politics. Didn't talk about sex. You didn't talk about food. God knows what they did talk about. All of these things were not polite. Money. You didn't talk about money sure. either. So, and all of those are the interesting things. I don't know what we talked about. I mean, my mother was an actress, so I guess we talked about theatre a lot and books and things, but we didn't talk about those things. And so there I was in France with people talking about food, and we were eating wonderful food. I was eating really good food in the family I stayed in. I was a mother's help, you know, an au pair. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I remember the very first day I learned so much, because the first day we went before breakfast to buy the bread, which the French do before breakfast every morning. Mm-hmm. And we went to three shops, one for the baguette, one for the croissant, and one for the cake. And I said, well, why don't we buy everything at one? Because they all sell everything. And she looked at me as if I was completely mad. She said, because this guy has the best croissant, this guy has the best baguette. And then we made the children's lunch that day. And she... I mean, the very fact that I spoke English would guarantee in her mind that I couldn't cook, and she was quite right. So I wasn't allowed to touch the food. But she made for the children, who were 6 months old and 18 months old. So they were two babies, a toddler and a baby. And she made two little plates with steak, potatoes, and salad. And the little steaks were seared on both sides, so they were rare in the middle and nice and brown on the outside. She rolled the new potatoes in butter with a bit of chives, and she turned the lettuce leaves in French dressing, all homemade. Mm. And she made these two perfect plates. And then I liquidized the babies, and she chopped up the toddlers. And the toddler sat in a high chair and the baby on my lap, and we sat down to have lunch. And that was my whole food philosophy learnt in that day, because it was... I've sort of never deviated from it. It's about good ingredients bought with a great deal of care, mm-hmm. cooking pretty well at the last minute, and doing it with love and attention and care, mm-hmm. making it look appetizing, and then sitting down and eating it, knees under, round a table, and talking to the children and talking to each other. And I think, you know, if we could just get children to learn to love good food like that, we wouldn't have an obesity problem. We wouldn't have half the problems we have if children just grew up learning to love good food. But I've been saying this for 50 years, Francis, and nobody's ever taken a blind bit of notice. I've made no difference. But I really believe it, that we should teach children to eat. And the way you teach children to eat is to teach them to cook and to teach them about food and to teach them to interest them in food.
Yeah, for sure. We'll be back with more of Prue Leaf, author of Bliss on Toast. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful, and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small batch drops of indulgent treats like 2 gram net carb Hero croissant or the 1 gram net carb Hero cheddar biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season.
In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're spending time with the British cooking icon and star of the Great British Baking Show, Prue Leaf. Let's get back to it with her.
At some point, you decided to go to culinary school. You moved from Paris to London to culinary school. Yeah, I think this was in 1916?
Yeah, about 69, yeah.
What was culinary school in London in 1960 like?
Well, I went to the Cordon Bleu, and it was a really good cookery school. It was the techniques were all classic French-based technique. We learned, you know, all the classic French dishes. But there was a sort of English country house feeling about the food. You know, it wasn't over-decorated. It wasn't, you know, carving sort of Snow White out of butter or lard and making the Eiffel Tower out of woven potato bits or something. And the Cordon Bleu, because it had started as a school to teach domestic cooks how to cook, it wasn't all about this hotel decoration stuff. It was much more about the quality of food. And so I learned a lot there. And then I had a bedsitter in London. And while I was still at school, I started to become a kind of cook for hire, and I'd go around and do your dinner party and so on. Mm-hmm. And then I'd built up a little, you know, a little following of customers all by word of mouth. And so that's how I started.
Yeah. And you said you would, when we spoke earlier, you said you've made sandwiches for construction workers and royal parties.
Yeah, exactly. In the end, I had hugely expensive clients. And of course, when I opened a restaurant, I got a lot of publicity because I was a woman. And as you said, there were not very many women who had smart restaurants. And even before we had a Michelin star, which did take a very long time to get, I had a lot of smart clientele because one of the reasons I think was because we had no rules. I didn't have a dress code. I've never thought restaurateurs should tell customers, you know, what they're to eat, what they're to drink. You know, if they want, I mean, nobody ever did it, but if somebody wanted to put a blob of ice cream into Chateau Latour first growth wine and they've bought it, they've got a perfect right to do it. And I would want my waiters to be cooperative and charming about it, not snobbish.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so we had no dress code. And we stayed open very late. And that meant that the theatre crowd could come after the theatre. Mm-hmm. And the music crowd would come. And so right at the beginning, from the very beginning, we had top actors like Alec Guinness and John Gielgud. And we had Lulu and the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. And all these people came to the restaurant. And really, we weren't that good. We weren't that good, but I had a lot of publicity because I was a woman. So, you know, people often say, how did you break the glass ceiling? But because I was always self-employed, there was no glass ceiling. I was making the rules. You know, women suffer when they've got a boss who is, you know, institutionally anti-women.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're your own boss, it's much easier.
When you say you weren't that good,
well, you know what
did that look like? And well, how did you get better? Because presumably you did.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I mean, even 10 years into my thing, I would look at my first menus and think, oh, God, that sounds dreadful. Because sometimes I would do things that I thought I ought to have on the menu because other restaurants had them or because somebody had recommended them. I mean, I remember once we had a dish on the menu which my head chef wanted to put on. And I honestly think it's the most disgusting dish that has ever existed. And I'd be interested to hear if any of your listeners have ever eaten it. It's called Oysters Mornay, and it's basically cooked oysters under a cheese sauce. Well, I mean, what a crime. I mean, I don't like cooked oysters anyway. I think they oysters should be absolutely as they come out of the sea. I don't even put vinegar on them. I just swallow them.
Yeah, I like them
as they are.
Straight, yeah.
And traditionally, oysters used to go into steak and kidney pies and things to bulk them up.
Sure.
Just extra protein. And it was just a cheap way
of getting... cheaper than the steak,
than the steak. But Oysters Mornay is truly disgusting. And we used to sell it. I mean, I don't remember anybody ever complaining about it. So presumably, not everybody hated it. And also, you know, I've been doing this one-woman show. And one of the reasons I'm in New York is because we... had a tryout the other night in the Darryl Roth Theatre in Union Square.
Mm.
And to be honest, Frances, that's the first time I've enjoyed doing this show, and I absolutely loved it because I love the audience. I'd done four in England, and I was quite nervous, and I didn't really enjoy it very much.
Mm.
But this was fantastic, and I loved it. So now I'm going to go ahead and do two more in New York, and then next year I'll do big tours.
That's terrific.
But anyhow, as part of the show, we've got film clips coming up behind me and photographs jumping up as I'm talking about the restaurant. And I'm talking about how much I love that restaurant, which I had for 25 years. And I just love being a restaurateur. So there's a long clip about it, but it ends up with one of the waiters. And we had these first course trolleys, big trolleys with choice on the trolley. And the waiter is dishing up food that looks so clumsy and so ugly. And you... just been listening to me talking about how delicate food should be and how light the first courses have to be, otherwise people won't buy a second course. And I'm banging on about the importance of elegance. And then the picture is sort of half a melon filled with prawns and Murray Rose sauce or something. It looks absolutely clumsy and terrible. Anyway, it's quite funny.
Well, you are a very harsh judge of your own restaurant, it turns out. And, you know, I think that brings us to, you know, we'll fast forward a few decades and here we are today, where, you know, most people in the States know of you as a judge on the Great British Bake Off, which I always forget. Is that the English title or maybe our title?
Bake Off is the English translation.
Okay, so we
baking
call it...
Baking Show.
Yeah, we call it the Great British Baking Show, even though in my mind, it's always going to be the Bake Off. Mm. And we know you as... one of the judges on the show, and in particular, a supportive and kind and loving judge. So it's sort of funny to hear you talk about your own restaurant just being god-awful.
Wasn't all god-awful.
Yeah, that's why I kept trying to lead you. Tell us about what was good, but you kept wanting to talk about how it was bad. But so tell us about your experience on the show. You've been on for, what is it now, like 4 or 5 seasons?
Uh-huh.
You were previously also a judge on a different show.
Great British Menu.
Yeah, where the contestants were professional chefs. Do you approach judging a professional chef differently than you do the amateur bakers on
No, baking show? I don't. I mean, I've judged food because I had a chef school, which is still very successful and still there, and another one in South Africa. I have judged thousands and thousands of students' exam dishes, if you like. So I'm not, I don't think, the greatest baker in the world, but I'm a damn good set of taste buds. And I don't judge anything any differently. I just do say what I think.
Sure.
And I suppose with Great British Menu, with professional chefs, I would be a little bit tougher if I thought that they were doing something really stupid. Like occasionally... professional chefs are so keen to show all their skills at once that they will give you a plate with far too many tastes on it. You know, there'll be a drizzle of this and a bit of foam of that and a Parmesan crisp and then some crumbly stuff. And then there'll be a couple of sauces and 2 or 3 main ingredients. And it's just exhausting. So I would say so quite bluntly because I think they should know better. And I went recently to a little restaurant in my local town, which is by a really top head chef. Anyway, when he told me it was a tasting menu, my heart sinks at a tasting menu. I know it's going to take forever. I'm going to feel I've eaten far too much. But he had probably his tasting menu was only six dishes, but none of them were bigger than a sort of small hen's egg. Mm-hmm. So even though you'd eaten six things, they were all exquisite. None of them had more than four ingredients in them. Mm. But the combination of ingredients was absolutely fantastic. So that's the way I think chefy chefs should go, rather than too much stuff on the plate.
Yeah. I mean, if it's only a hen's egg's worth of food, they could probably put it on a piece of toast.
Yeah.
And just serve it to you that way.
Even better on a bit of toast.
Okay, so let's go back to the baking show. You know, the show has you know, obviously immensely popular in the UK, also here in the States. And I think the people who talk about it, the fans of the show, you know, the first thing we always say is how much it's about the feeling. There is this sort of positive, lovely presence, a kindness to the show. What's the feeling like on set?
Exactly that. You know, the company makes Bake Off is called Love Productions. And my husband always says it, they're love by name and love by nature.
Yeah.
Some of those cameramen have been in the show for 17 years or whatever it is. For 15 years, since Bake Off started. Most of them have been there 5 years or 10 years. Nobody leaves because it's really lovely. I have never heard anybody quarrel on that set.
Hmm.
Nobody getting cross. You know, the only time I remember being a little bit amazed and finding, you know, Paul's eyes rolling to heaven, was when we were filming the Great American Baking Show, which we're doing and will come out next year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's will be live streamed by Roku.
Okay.
And it's all American contestants. So I had thought it would be a little bit more difficult because most of the game shows that I've seen in America, contestants are quite aggressive, really.
Sure. There's this famous cliche line of, I'm not here to make friends.
Yeah.
There's always someone who says, I'm not here to make friends.
Oh, no. Well, that's nonsense. You should be there to make friends. Anyway, so we were filming the American show. And to be honest, I'll tell you what, the atmosphere in the tent, it just, all those American contestants were exactly like the British ones. They were supportive. They bonded well. They were absolutely a delight.
Going back to the British version, I feel like in a lot of ways that show, that was notable to me when I first started watching it. At first I like sort of noticed this, and then a few seasons in, I was like, oh, this must be sort of intentional. There's a philosophy behind this. And I started to think that the show really seems like in the casting, that it really leans into the racial and ethnic diversity of a contemporary Britain. It really sort of shows this modern idea of what Britain is, right? And it is a place of many different cultures.
Yeah, it is.
And I think there's a lot of people who love it for that.
Yeah.
But I think we need to talk about Mexican Week because that did cause quite a stir. And a lot of viewers were upset by what they thought were stereotypical jokes or maybe, you know, letting on some ignorance. What is your thought on that?
Well, to be honest, I was really upset when I saw how much distress it had caused.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as you say, Bake Off is really proud of the fact that they are very respectful about, I mean, when you do somebody else's cuisine, it should be, you're doing it because you want to celebrate it and because you like it. And so the idea that we would be anyway patronizing or mocking or, I mean, to be honest, you know, I'm sure if we did it again, we would have not done it exactly like that because we did not expect, did not imagine for a minute and certainly never intended to be offensive to anybody because, as you say, that's not the Bake Off show. And the whole philosophy is diversity and kindness and tolerance and so on. But I think there are only three challenges. So we picked probably too much of a, maybe they were too cliched, the tacos or the whatever. But certainly it wasn't, we have to have something that people will recognize as Mexican. And I think the people who were upset felt that we weren't celebrating what's happened in Mexico now and would have much rather we had taken dishes that were more interesting, more moderner, whatever. So, you know, I mean, I'm just I know everybody felt, God, we did not mean to offend anybody. How could that have happened? Sure. And of course, those the jokes, which perhaps were a bit, certainly did cause a bit of offence. Those boys make bad jokes all the time.
Sure.
That's what they do. They behave like 15-year-olds. And that's what they were doing.
Yeah. I mean,
did you think it was bad?
You know, I think I certainly understand a perspective where here's an opportunity to showcase something that, take this out of like how I saw it as a viewer, as myself. Mm-hmm. But if I saw this as a viewer where, I had an emotional or a family connection to Mexican culture or cuisine, I think probably, my perspective would have been something like that. Like, oh, you could have showcased less stereotypical items or something like that. And I think the thing with the jokes is it's not so much, oh my God, they said these horrible things, but it's more like, everyone's having a bit of a laugh about how little they know about us. And that just doesn't feel nice. Mm. So I can certainly understand that. On some level, I wonder why this theme was chosen, because I watch it as an American. And as an American, we are, we're literally close to Mexico, and Mexican cuisine is so influential here. And then I think about it, the fact that it's a British show.
And you're much more knowledgeable.
There are certain things that we just have a different perspective on just from proximity. And a little bit, I was like, oh, if there was an American show and the theme was Swiss cuisine and everyone's like, I don't know anything about Swiss cuisine. I was curious as to why that theme was chosen for a British show.
Well, I mean, we have to, we often do choose other nations' food. Mm-hmm, just. Yeah. Because it's more interesting, we want to. And generally, it's a celebration, and we certainly mean it to be a celebration, but obviously we got that one a bit wrong.
Yeah. But, this is how we learn, right? And we move on in the future. If you have one more minute, I would love to ask you, where did you get your fashion sense?
My obsession with color, you mean?
I love the big color, the colorful glasses, big jewelry. Do you have a sense of why you're drawn to those things?
Well, I think it may be because I'm South African and it's a land of strong color. Mm. Look at African jewelry. It's nearly always red, green, white, African colors. But I've always liked it. But then when I married my husband, I'm famous for geriatric love. I mean, I fell in love with my husband when I was 70. And he was a fashion designer. So he's been very encouraging because he's, I'll often put on a pair of earrings and I'll say, is this too much? And I'll say, no, wear a bracelet as well. I honestly, Frances, I think that too many women who get to past middle age, they think that they somehow have to go and sit and knit in the corner or some old-fashioned idea of how women should behave. Women will write to me and say, I so admire you because you wear these bright colors. I would love to do that, and I used to in my youth, but now I feel I can't. It's not appropriate. Mm. What do you mean it's not appropriate? Older women need more help than young ones anyway. Well, young women can just look great because they are young and they're beautiful. I'm trying to get older women to realize that if they put on a yellow coat in the middle of winter, it'll cheer them up. Mm. Color is cheerful.
Yeah.
And
well, help or not, I hear you on the idea of this notion of women as they age are told, oh, your time to be seen is gone.
Yeah.
And I love the idea of saying, well, first of all, what I put on is for me, not necessarily for you.
Yeah.
And everyone has the right to look how they want.
Absolutely.
Look in a way that makes them happy. I love that.
And I ended up, designing my own specs because I couldn't get ones with enough color on them. Now there's lots of colored specs around.
Well, thank you for bringing your color into this room, this drab gray studio.
It's like hotels, Now hotels are all so gray and boring.
Well, it was great to talk with you, Prue.
Thank you, Frances. I enjoyed it a lot. Thank you.
Trueleaf is a judge on the Great British Baking Show and author of a new book, Bliss on Toast. You can find her recipe for tomatoes with English pesto on toasted focaccia at splendidtable.org. Coming up, another iconic British cook, the incredible Nigella Lawson. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's table at hero.co. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is a show for curious cooks and eaters. Nigella Lawson needs almost no introduction, right? The British cooking icon is one of the greatest food writers in the English language. She starred in many TV shows on both sides of the Atlantic and is the author of her latest book, Cook, Eat, Repeat. So the last time she joined us a few years ago, she defended the honor of home cooking, and in her latest book, she writes about her love of simple ingredients and how cooking becomes a part of life. Nigella, it is so great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's so wonderful to see you. It just feels like such a celebration to be able to do this face to face.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for coming to our country.
Oh, such a pleasure.
And thank you for writing this book. It's truly a beautiful read. I mean, it's an interesting cookbook because it's almost more, I might say, a collection of essays and stories as it is recipes, although there are many, many recipes in it. And, you know, as a writer, as an editor, reading it is such a pleasure. Like, no one describes food the way you do.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think that, you know, a cookbook can take many forms.
Sure.
And we all need to find a way to bring not only the recipes we write, but perhaps also to explain something of the sensibility.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be our voice. You know, we all have our own voice, and it's so important that a cookbook has a voice.
Sure, yeah.
And that can be so varied, and in a way you don't want this sort of feeling of every cookbook sounding like another one.
Sure.
And that's one of the things that so interests me about writing about food.
Yeah, I think. Well, I mean, this is your 12th book, and, you know, so you've done it plenty.
It's always frightening.
Is it?
Well, to some extent, most things that are worth doing are a bit frightening.
Sure.
And I think that the more books you do, the harder it is in terms of recipes, because you don't ever, I don't ever want to put a recipe in just for the sake of having a recipe.
Sure.
But I think that certain things do make you nervous, but that's also what hones your focus.
Mm.
And was it Eleanor Roosevelt who said, you have to do one thing that frightens you every day? And I think that to some extent, you can't expect to take on something that you feel so heartfelt about and to feel casual about it. That would be disastrous.
Mm.
So I don't mean, you know, I was handicapped by fear, but I certainly, there's always that fear when you start a book.
Yeah.
Am I going to be able to do it? But I think the before doing anything is difficult.
Sure.
I love it when I'm writing, but it can take me quite a lot to propel myself into the chair by the computer.
Yeah. It's funny. I have a friend whose father always had that adage. It's like the hardest part of any project is actually getting into the chair.
Yes. And that's so true for everything, really.
Well, since we're talking about this book, and this idea of recipes, you start this book actually with an essay that asks the question, what is a recipe? having, again, written out 12 cookbooks, what do you mean by asking that question?
Well, I think how people have viewed the recipe does change as fashions for cooking and the age we live in. So if you were to go far back in time, you would be unlikely to find measurements all the time.
Sure.
It would be take some butter, you know, mix it to a paste with some flour.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what a recipe would have been thought of then.
Sure.
And then you get the sort of recipes which are now very, very detailed. I mean, a recipe can take many forms, but a recipe that is very, very detailed and gives absolutely everything, but from a more technical point of view, without somehow trying to evoke what the recipe might appeal to in a person or why it's there. And then a recipe, to a certain extent, can be something of a literary endeavor because you're trying to use language to allow the reader to have sensation of what it might feel like, either to roll that dough out or the smell of a stew as you add some fennel seeds or something. So for me, I think it's about taking people away, both to enjoy the lingering on the page, but you have to be able to, the reader has somehow to feel she or he in the kitchen while they're reading it, and it makes them more likely to go there. I think it has to straddle many disciplines. But for me also, cooking, or therefore the recipe form, is also takes in anthropology. And it takes in social history and the movement of people. And so there's so much going on in a recipe. It's so interesting to see all these different components. And it's the dynamic between all those disciplines, if you like, that makes recipes so, for me, enduringly interesting and from different perspectives. But that's all well and good. Having said all those things, that's true. But a recipe also has to be 100% reliable, and it has to aid the reader. And I would say, furthermore, in an ideal world, I would like to think when I write a recipe that although I am giving the reader, you know, very clear instructions, I would hope also that I'm also imparting just something about the nature of cooking itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult to get the balance right.
Yeah.
And to get the balance right while not writing a book that's heavier than, you know, than a suitcase of beer. But nevertheless, I try, but I think brevity is not always an indication of ease. You know, that there's such a fashion in cookbooks that
for
most
short,
editors
and
want
simple, and
want people, I understand this, not to have to turn a page when they're following a recipe. And yet I feel sometimes when a recipe is sort of written to that prescriptive model, regardless of what the recipe is, it can mean you leave out the sort of markers you could be offering your readers about, not just say, give it 20 minutes, but you want to say by which time it will have slightly begun coming away at the sides of the pan and may begin splitting on top. If you haven't got time to add the details, I think it makes it harder for the cook, even though it might make it nice and neat and clear on the page.
I totally understand what you're saying, both as someone who has written recipes in the past and now as an editor where I edit, you know, literally hundreds of them at a time for cookbooks. But you know what made me really, really hyper aware of that was a few days ago, this was so sweet. My child, who's in second grade, her teacher came to me and said, "Hey, would you like to come in one day and do a little cooking class for our kids?" And I thought, "Oh, that'd be so fun." And I came in, and it was supposed to be a Halloween, so you know, the kids were going to be eating just ungodly amounts of candy. And
yes.
I thought, "How about I come in and I'll show you how to make roasted broccoli?"
Yes.
Because my kid really loves roasted broccoli, and maybe some of the kids in class will too, and it'd be a nice way to you know, get kids to eat their vegetables that day. So she said, "Sure." It was actually amazing. I was shocked at how many of the kids in the class love broccoli.
Yes.
So that was amazing. But I also wanted to make sure that I had a written recipe for the kids to take home if they want to make it, you know, with their, with their grown-ups at home or whatever. And I did exactly what you were thinking of, which is I wanted to make sure there was detail. you know, really explain it, assuming that the child knows nothing of cooking. Right?
Yes.
This is how you would cut it. How big should it be? I like to use my fingers for this, but you can use a knife. Roast it till it looks like this. Move it on the pan so it's all in one layer, so it doesn't look crowded. Like, you know, da-da-da-da-da. And I did that with the spirit of, let me tell you everything you would need to know to make this in case you've never made this before. Yes. So really simplify it. And then I printed it out. And I realized I had an entire sheet of paper entirely covered in words that I'm going to hand a seven-year-old. The level of intimidation to see that much, you know, language on a page.
And then people think this must be so complicated.
Exactly.
It's a very, it's a conundrum, actually. It's very hard to get right. Did you, in the end, make it much finer? Did you?
No, I just, we just went with it and just figured that, well, it was time to go to school. So.
Yes, you can carry on. Yeah, and you do have a job, you know, Yes.
Okay. So actually, let's get to one of the recipes in this book. Mm. It's funny for me to say the recipes in the book because it's, again, it's such a fascinating read. And there are recipes in the traditional style of ingredient list and method. But then in the headnote to that recipe, you have other recipes that
you're just writing. It's like a stream of culinary consciousness.
But I want to get to one of the dishes in particular because I'm so drawn to it. And it's the smoky squid and beans, which has such a like a mysterious, cool ring to it. But it seems very simple, right? It just seems like you warm up olive oil with some smoked paprika, a little bit of chili, and you warm up some canned beans in that.
Yes.
And then you just sort of gently sauté some squid and you're kind of done.
Well, yes, but I wanted to talk about, you know, the sort of food I rustle up for myself often when I just want something delicious. And I might not have a lot of time. And I don't think cooking needs to be complicated to have actually quite complex flavors.
Sure.
Various things came to me about this recipe. And I suppose what led me to it really was a love of smoked paprika. And I'm always looking for ways to use it. So this is a dish I just felt like saying that a recipe doesn't have to involve 3 hours of your time to warrant your attention. How's this? You cook a bit of squid, not too much, warm through the beans later. It's all in one
just canned
pot.
Beans.
Just canned beans. And then I use sherry for it. I use Amontillado, but any dry sherry. And what I find that does is it helps tenderize the squid. By the way, I should say, if for people who don't want alcohol, you could easily do, instead of the sherry, you could easily do lemon juice or orange juice or a mixture of lemon and orange juice. Orange, fantastic in savory cooking, I think. So then rinsing your beans, just rinse the beans. So I have, you have to move quite fast. So I get a bowl there, I get the beans waiting, and then so I use something that's sort of wok-shaped, but also has a lid.
Okay.
So you use good olive oil for this when you do it because it's not going to get incredibly hot and it's part of the dressing.
Yeah.
And then I always like a bit of lemon zest. Again, you could use orange zest. And now I use some red pepper flakes and sweet smoked paprika. Now, of course, anyone could change the amount they use. Some people might want a really fiery dish and some people might just want it to have warmth
a
little pinprick of heat. And so that I just cook for a while. There's nothing much else going on. I'm not doing onions or anything like that, but I do use a bit of tomato paste, okay? And I cook it for like a minute or so. Then the beans go in. And then the oil is quite red by then from the paprika
And the tomato paste.
And the, yes, but it's even redder before a bit, you know, how chili does that. But now it's much redder, sort of orangey red. And you might need to add more water. You don't want them to go dry and sticky. And I cook them with a very low heat with a lid. And they're quite big, butter beans, so you want them to be warm all the way through. So then I tip those out because it's not the squid won't take very long and I'd rather make the beans wait than the squid. And then there's a bit more oil, some more pepper flakes, and then I go a bit high. And then because the squid's been in the sherry or other juice, I squeeze that out so it's not too wet when it goes in the oil just because otherwise it'll spit all over you. And then I just carry on cooking them just so they have just until they're cooked through and opaque. You don't want to overcook them.
Yeah.
And then, because I don't want to waste it, all the sherry or the lemon or orange juice you have in your dish, I pour in at the very end when they're cooked through. And then I just, you know, mix them with the beans and there. And then, of course, I might think, oh, I need more lemon or more salt. But, of course, everyone will do what they want.
Sure.
There isn't a right or wrong. I think if I had to say that, I think that American cookbooks sometimes can be much more absolute.
Yeah.
And I feel I come from a land of equivocation. Or that's me. That's me. But you have to bring yourself to the dish. It is a collaboration between the ingredients and the person putting them in a pan. And so I think at all times you have to trust your palate.
Yeah.
And I think that makes people enjoy cooking more too, because it's not about, is this going to go right or wrong? It's like, do I want it to taste like that, or do I want it to be sharper?
Right. Well, it's funny because, you know, you have this really lovely line in the book where you say a lot of people think of recipes as formulas, but you think of them as a conversation.
Yes, I think of them as a conversation. I think of them also as quite an autobiographical form, because in a way you're telling the story of food that plays a part in your life.
Yeah.
And but you're also really giving an account of what it feels like to be cooking it. But it is a story, it's a conversation, and the difficulty is I can't hear the answer of the person at home, but in a way, because of social media and things like that, you can continue the conversation.
Yeah.
On,
I made this, but on, with this instead.
Yes, or it was people lovely. Can ask. Yeah. And I can't cope with all forms of social media, although I'm on all of them and I post and I do it myself. And I love it because often I get, someone will say, for example, you know, I didn't have the squid and I decided to use some, you know, bit of tuna. Well, actually, you know, tuna and beans has a very, you know, has a very noble tradition.
Yeah.
And that's good too. So it's lovely having the sort of cross-pollination of ideas.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what we all love, those of us who love food. We love it when we chat to one another, and I really value that.
Yeah. Well, like the people who tweeted you, I'm sure. It was a pleasure talking with you, Nigella.
Oh, it's so lovely to talk to you.
Thank you so much for coming.
Anytime, and I hope you know I really mean that, and not in a threatening way.
Yeah. Nigella Lawson's latest book is Cook, Eat, Repeat. And you can find that recipe for smoky squid and beans at splendidtable.org. And I have to tell you, I made it for dinner last night, but made three different alterations, but that's kind of part of the deal. And it was terrific. Anyway, that is our show for today. Talk to you next week. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table was created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lupke, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. Additional thanks this week to Gary O'Keefe and Marketplace's New York Bureau. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.